and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, friends and supporters of Julian Assange are holding two rallies tomorrow at 11 o'clock Eastern Time in Lafayette Square in front of the White House, and another at 4:30 at the British Embassy to protest the conditions to which Julian is being subjected inside the Ecuadorian Embassy in London. Julian is not permitted to have internet access, nor is he allowed any visitors other than his attorneys. Next, German Chancellor Angela Merkel accepted a two-week deadline to win agreement on a tougher immigration policy in a concession to her coalition partner. She also announced that the European Union heads of state will likely hold a summit on immigration and refugees June 23rd and 24th. Meanwhile, President Trump today said incorrectly that the German people have turned against Merkel because of immigration and that Germany has become a violent and dangerous place. Then, Iván Duque, the conservative, some would say populist candidate in Colombia, has won that country's presidency with 54% of the vote. He finished 12 points ahead of former guerrilla Gustavo Petro, whose performance was the best ever for a left-wing candidate in one of South America's most conservative countries. Duque promised to heal the rifts among Colombians, but the election revealed that those rifts are wide and deep. And then today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And finally, today we continue our weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits, with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. All that and more is coming up on Loud and Clear. But first we turn to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Friends and supporters of Julian Assange are holding two rallies tomorrow, one at 11 a.m. Eastern Time in Lafayette Square in front of the White House and another at 4:30 p.m. at the British Embassy in Washington, to protest the conditions to which Julian is being subjected inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Julian is not permitted to have internet access, nor is he allowed any visitors other than his attorneys. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Kevin is also instrumental in putting on these two rallies. Kevin, tell us about the rallies and how people can get involved.
Thanks for having me on. The rallies are the sixth anniversary of Julian Assange going into the Ecuadorian embassy to avoid being prosecuted for espionage by the United States and facing probably the rest of his life in jail just for being a reporter, editor of WikiLeaks. So the rally tomorrow at 11 o'clock will be at the White House. We urge you to come and join us. We'll have some great speakers like Ray McGovern, Medea Benjamin, Marsha Coleman Adebayo, who's an EPA whistleblower. A bunch of really great people will come out. And our objective is to really show unity for Julian Assange. We're calling for the end of his persecution. We're calling for him to be able to leave the Ecuadorian embassy without being threatened with being prosecuted or extradited to the United States.
You know, the United Nations has ruled that Julian Assange is the victim of arbitrary detention. And when the UN rules like this, when the UN speaks in that voice, in the past, people have been released from arbitrary detention. In this case, that's not happened. And Kevin Zeese, who's our guest, and Kevin is an attorney and an activist and one of the editors of PopularResistance.org. Kevin, the thing that really, I think, is, well, maybe it's not astounding, but it should be astounding, is that, you know, you think about the mainstream media, the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, Fox, you name it, liberal or conservative, they've all used the materials provided by this media source, WikiLeaks, for their own reporting. I mean, like fundamental to their many of their biggest and most important stories. Now the government is obviously, through the mechanism of arbitrary detention, trying to force Julian's life to be hell or force him out of that embassy so that they can arrest him and put him in prison. And none of these media sources who use WikiLeaks stuff are speaking up. You're speaking up. The organizers tomorrow are speaking up. But there's a deafening silence, or worse, when it comes to the corporate-owned media in this country.
That's exactly right. What Julian Assange is in WikiLeaks, they are the center of a key battle of our era. the battle of who controls the media narrative. And right now that narrative is controlled by a very small group of mega corporations who put out the word for the government and for big business interests, and the people's views not heard. WikiLeaks broke through that. They provide a tool for democratized media where people actually have influence over the message. So people who work in a big business corporation, or people who work in government, can blow the whistle anonymously, provide documents, and then people in independent media can write about those documents, and then people in social media can spread that information through their networks. And so you have a real challenge between corporate media versus people's media, and Assange is at the center of that. So that's why those big corporate interests are not going to support Assange, because he's undermining their control, their narrative. He's undermining their monopoly over the media message. And that's why it's so important for people to stand up for him. And he's not alone. There are a lot of whistleblowers. I'm also on the board of the Courage Foundation, which was set up to protect whistleblowers. And there's a real need for that. One of our speakers that's going to be at the event tomorrow is Marsha Coleman Adebayo. She was working in the EPA during the Clinton-Gore era and saw environmental crimes the U.S. was allowing to occur in Africa. She tried to get the EPA to take action. They refused. She blew the whistle, went public, and then she was punished for being a whistleblower. She sued and won. That's a case that we need to – those are the kinds of cases we need to be encouraging. Assange is the John Peter Zenger case of the 21st century. Zenger was the case in colonial America, pre-revolutionary America, where the idea of freedom of the press became popular. He was charged with writing things that the British government didn't like. He went to court and he challenged it. And in the end, that's how we got freedom of speech. That's how we got freedom of the press. We need that again today. The issue is, what does freedom of press, what does freedom of speech, what does internet freedom mean in the 21st century?
That's really such an important and central point, that if we don't support Julian Assange, if we turn our backs on him, if we walk away from him, then there's nobody else. Then the whole system falls apart. The system that's been demanding transparency and demanding that our government tell us what they do in our name. You know, Julian, to me, is a very thin line standing between our government and its people. He's the only thing that's stopping our government, in my view, from moving toward even greater authoritarianism.
Yeah, and there's the old cliche that the first casualty in war is the truth, but it's also the second casualty, the third casualty, the fourth casualty. Because the government can't really sustain wars like the war in Iraq unless it lies to the people. Like, it couldn't really sustain the war in Vietnam because the American people found out the truth about the Vietnam War. And Kevin, just remind the audience, say, like the videotape that WikiLeaks released that was in the Pentagon's custody, and the Pentagon wouldn't give it to Reuters, and Reuters had filed a FOIA request with the Pentagon. But that video, I can't remember exactly what year. Collateral damage. Go ahead.
Collateral damage video, exactly. And that's one of many examples of the truth that WikiLeaks was able to get out. The collateral damage video showed wanton killing by the U.S. military on civilians and on reporters, shooting from helicopters at people on the ground. And even people who came to aid those who were shot were also shot and killed. And that video, which has had millions of views, came out of WikiLeaks. But WikiLeaks also released videos and stories about so much else, including Guantanamo Bay, including torture in Iraq, including the Arab dictators during Arab Spring, and the Clinton emails. So much important information that would not have gotten out without WikiLeaks. I would say, to John's point, that in many ways, WikiLeaks has already won the battle. They've already shown a way for people to get the truth out. And so it's a question of someone picking up that baton, no matter what happens to Assange, that has to continue. And it's a bigger battle than Assange now. Net neutrality, that's part of the attack on independent and social media. The algorithms being used by Google in their search engines to prevent people from hearing the voices of critics and people from the left. Facebook cutting back on its control of getting greater control about what news is shared on Facebook. There's a battle going on. Assange is at the center of it, but it's bigger than Assange. It's a battle for what we have in the 21st century. What does freedom of press mean? What does our right to information mean? How do we have freedom of speech without a right to information? And what does our access to the Internet mean? Can we go anywhere we want? Can we read anything we want? Or is that going to be controlled by big business and by government? That's what this is about, and Assange is a good centerpiece of that battle, a battle we have to all fight and win. So I hope people join us 11 o'clock tomorrow at the White House and 4:30 tomorrow at the British Embassy.
That's the voice of Kevin Zeis. Kevin is an attorney. He's an activist. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out his work and the work of others there at popularresistance.org. Kevin is one of the organizers for tomorrow's demonstration, the first demonstration to show solidarity with and demand the freedom for Julian Assange, begins at 11 a.m., 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, across from the White House in Lafayette Park, and then at 4:30 p.m. at the British Embassy here in Washington, D.C. Kevin, you know, I think you're so right, and we have a minute left. It is about Julian Assange, because we must defend Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, but it's greater than that, because if the government succeeds or the mainstream media succeeds in shutting down, crushing Julian Assange, that also sends a chilling message to anyone else who's a whistleblower, anyone else who wants to tell the truth. Go ahead.
That's right. That's right. Because as Julian Assange said, courage is contagious. But fear can be contagious, too. It's very important that no matter what happens with Assange, people continue to stand up. The activity of using your social media and seeing yourself as a media outlet is a revolutionary act. And if you start to be conscious about that and use your social media capacity to reach thousands of people, as everybody is capable of doing, we can overtake the core media. We can get the message out. We can win the battle of narrative. And the truth can come out not just on war, as you pointed out, Brian, but on every issue. We are lied to constantly. It's always a battle between the fiction they tell us and the truth that's reality. And I hope people recognize their important role as being part of the media today.
That was the voice of Kevin Zeis. Kevin joins us from Baltimore. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out his work at popularresistance.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel accepted a two-week deadline to win agreement on a tougher immigration policy in a concession to her coalition partner. She also announced that the European Union heads of state will likely hold a summit on immigration and refugees on June 23rd and 24th. Meanwhile, President Trump today said, incorrectly, that the German people have turned against Merkel because of immigration and that Germany has become a violent and dangerous place. We're joined from Paris by Jasmine O'Hara, founder of the Worldwide Tribe, who has been involved in providing aid to refugees in refugee camps. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Jasmine, let's start with you. Tell us exactly what the magnitude of this problem is in Europe. You know, we're so focused on the issue here in the States. I think most Americans don't really know what's going on in Europe.
Absolutely. Well, this is a humanitarian crisis unlike any other that we have seen of our generation. You know, this is the biggest humanitarian crisis of our time in Europe, with unprecedented numbers of migrants and refugees arriving to our shores in Greece. And it's huge here at the moment, what we're seeing on the ground.
Yeah. And like, how many people are we talking about?
So it's difficult to say when it comes to numbers, because there's such a movement of people and it's fluctuating all the time. And not just that, what we're really seeing on the ground is a lack of any kind of recording of who is where, and making sure that people are aware and actually documented and accounted for. So it's difficult to talk numbers, but I'm on the ground in Paris at the moment, and there's a couple of thousand refugees sleeping on the streets of Paris currently. Here we're talking in the thousands.
Nicole, this actually surprised me, the scope of this problem. The Washington Post today had an article saying that Merkel over the weekend barely fended off the collapse of her government. I had no idea that the problem was so serious in Germany that it risked bringing down the government.
Yeah, so she's only had this government for a couple of weeks now this term. And you're right. I think it did get pretty serious. And I don't think that it's entirely fixed yet at all. It doesn't sound like Seehofer. Horst Seehofer is the head of the CSU, which is one of her partners. She's in the CDU. And Seehofer is kind of coming really far from the right. And this is essentially because the CSU, Seehofer's party, is facing a challenge down in Bavaria where they're centered. So they're being challenged by some really right-wing groups, including the Alternative for Germany, which is fully, fully anti-immigrant. So this has kind of started recently. And so Seehofer, who's normally worked with Merkel pretty closely, is starting to really push back on some of her pro-immigration policies. And so the only thing that's happened at this point, nothing has really changed. Neither of them have really backed down at all. But what has happened is Seehofer has said, well, you know, I won't move forward with my anti-immigration policies as the interior minister. I'll give you 2 weeks. And that's when the EU summit is going to happen. I'll give you 2 weeks. And if you and the other EU leaders can come up with something that works for everybody, then, you know, that's fine. But if you can't come up with something, then, you know, he has the power essentially to tell cops to turn away immigrants who have been registered elsewhere in the EU.
And Jez, this problem is not unique to Germany. This is happening really everywhere around the EU, is it not?
Yes. As I say, I'm in Paris at the moment, but I work a lot in France, in Greece, and we're seeing it across mainland Europe, less so in the UK because of the geography of the situation. Less people are making it to the UK. But in mainland Europe, yeah, it's really across the board. We're seeing a huge amount of refugees arriving.
Yeah. And just for clarification, so Seehofer, who is the partner of Angela Merkel, Merkel is the fourth, has just won her fourth election. She's the prime minister of Germany. She's a Christian Democrat, right of center party. Seehofer is the Christian Social Union in Bavaria, in other words, to the right of the Christian Democrats. And then you have the Alternative for Germany, AfD, which is even further to the right. So the crisis here, just so our audience understands, is not really because there's been a profound shift or new developments with the refugees in Germany or in Europe. It's a political crisis because the right wing is using refugees as a punching bag and then demanding further and further, quote, tough laws against refugees in defiance of the EU's policy, whereby the EU is saying to all of the member states, all 28 members of the EU, that there had to be some proportionality in terms of who accepted all of these refugees. And they're refugees coming from North Africa, from the Middle East, from South Asia. They're coming because of war. They're coming because of the tremendous immiseration of people, the poverty caused by the policies of neoliberal capitalism. They are victims, and yet they are being treated as the wrongdoers, the criminals, just really because they exist. Go ahead.
Trump actually today tweeted and was right in line with what you were talking about, Brian. He said, crime in Germany is way up. Big mistake made all over Europe in allowing millions of people in who have so strongly and violently changed their culture. First of all, this is just blatantly not true. Germany's crime rate last year was the lowest since it was in 1992. I mean, that's just absolutely false. But because that's so false, this is just fanning the flames of racism and xenophobia. It's just trying to make all of this worse for people. And we're seeing these kinds of talking points, this kind of crime-ridden talking point all over Europe and clearly in America as well.
Go ahead, Jez.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. You know, it really is the case that I am seeing the impact of these very right-wing policies on the ground here in Europe because people aren't being recognised as existing. And it's a very much out of sight, out of mind kind of mentality where people aren't being registered. People aren't being given proper procedures to go through to seek asylum. So we are the effects of these right-wing governments in Paris, for example, is that camps are being evacuated and people are being dispersed. But there is no real procedure in place to deal with the amount of people arriving.
And we know that, you know, these refugees are not the people who are causing violence. What's causing violence is NATO bombings, right? What's causing violence is the fact that we're not addressing climate change, which is causing disasters, natural disasters all over the world. And, you know, if we were to put time and money and resources and efforts into dealing with those crises rather than, the EU or NATO kind of trying to dominate globally, I think we would have a very different result and we wouldn't be dealing with this crisis in the first place.
Absolutely. And to put it very simply, the refugees are victims of this violence instead of the cause. You know, many of them are fleeing persecution and violence and things like terrorist attacks in their own country. So to put them in the category of causing such things is really, really misguided.
One of the things that does happen is, of course, there is some violence. There's some crimes that will be committed by some refugee. If you have millions of people who are refugees, there's going to be some criminal activity. What's actually happening is that this very, very limited activity of criminal conduct is then magnified a millionfold by the right-wing anti-immigrant politicians and the media, magnified. And so the narrative becomes this particular immigrant, say from Syria or from Afghanistan, did something to a German or something to someone from France.
Right.
And so the impression is that these hordes of refugees, lawless hordes, are coming and descending onto Europe. They're not Christians. They're Muslim. They're not white. They're darker people. Again, it's not that there's never, ever the absence of crime, but there's very little. And so what's happened really is a political hit operation by right-wing politicians.
We've actually seen a decrease in crime in Germany in particular over the last few years. And the decrease it's a more substantial decrease for immigrants to Germany. The decrease in, German residents committing crime is less of a decrease. So we are seeing fewer and fewer and fewer refugees being the people committing the crimes, and it's the German residents who are. But that's all besides the point, because the crime rate is very low in Germany. That is not the issue. This is just racist bigotry that's happening.
And we see that all over the place, too. We see the same thing in Greece. You know, in Greece, crime has always been very, very low, and violent crime is very rare. But then there was one case recently where two Afghan refugees were trying to steal a camera from a man. He resisted. They stabbed him and killed him. Very, very rare crime. But then that provided the impetus for the Golden Dawn, this neo-Nazi party, to run rampage through the city and find and beat as many refugees as they could find.
Yeah. Jazz, we have 1 minute left. Who are the refugees, or where do they come from in the main, in where you are in Paris?
So we're working with lots of Afghans at the moment, but we see in France lots of also from coming via North Africa. So we have Eritreans, we have Sudanese. But in Greece, I work with predominantly Syrians. So really a representation of lots of different crises around the world that I'm working with. And there's a big melting pot of people.
Yeah, this flow of people is the consequence of war and economic privation, and also, by the way, climate change. Around the world, I know we've run out of time. Around the world, there's more people on the move right now than any time since the end of World War II. The estimates by the UN is that 60 million people are on the move, 60 million. So this is going to continue to be a political issue and a political crisis of the first magnitude.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Paris by Jasmine O'Hara, founder of the Worldwide Tribe, who has been involved in providing aid to refugees in refugee camps. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Roussel. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Iván Duque, the conservative, some would say populist candidate in Colombia, has won that country's presidency with 54% of the vote. He finished 12 points ahead of former guerrilla Gustavo Petro, whose performance was the best ever for a left-wing candidate in one of South America's most conservative countries. Duque promised to heal the rifts among Colombians, but the election revealed that those rifts are wide and deep. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by James Jordan. He's a member of the Alliance for Global Justice and has been deeply involved in supporting the Colombian peace process. And we're also joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dodson. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be here.
James, I'd like to start with you. This election was important in a number of ways. First of all, Gustavo Petro did very, very well, being only 12 points behind Iván Duque. The real importance here, though, is what happens to the peace process now that the conservatives have won this election. What do you think?
Well, I think we're still trying to figure all that out. I mean, first of all, it's premature to say that the peace process is dead. It's still the law of the land, and changes still have to be approved through the Congress. Unfortunately, the congressional elections in March, they were just filled with fraud and also filled with a great deal of intimidation. And intimidation repression has been the context in which this whole electoral season took place and developed. So it's a kind of status quo in terms of the Congress in Colombia, and the presidency has taken a turn even to the farther right. But the peace process is still the law of the land. Popular movements are very strong, and as you said, the candidacy of Petro won millions of votes, more than 8 millions of votes. So I think that the clamor in the streets for the peace process to continue will be strong, but the repression is probably going to just keep itching up. So it's a very difficult period.
Paul, how is the rest of the region looking at this race? Are they looking at it any differently than they have previous races for the presidency of Colombia?
To some extent, I would say yes. The current situation in Colombia has changed quite dramatically since the last presidential elections, mainly with the issues of the peace process, as James was explaining. The electoral results are going to impact, especially on Venezuela, but the entire region, I would say, quite strongly. If the peace process breaks down in Colombia and war starts to reignite itself in the country, this will have a massive knock-on impact, not just on the neighbours, Colombia's neighbours, but on the whole region. So we're talking about issues of emigration. There's estimated that anything up to 6 million Colombians cross the border into Venezuela at the height of the civil war, obviously impacting Venezuelan services, health, education, transport, and everything else. It's also going to have a big impact, this electoral result, in terms of the regional alliances. There's been a big push in recent months, mainly led by the U.S. government, to rally right-wing forces in Latin America against the Venezuelan government. The Group of Lima, which is a new group which has been set up of right-wing governments, is every day more powerful in the region. And within this context, we can look at what's happened in Brazil, in Chile, in Argentina, and a few other countries as well. The victory of Duque in Colombia will very much reinforce this Group of Lima, will very much reinforce the American-led alliance against Caracas. And this is obviously going to be worrying for our government here in Venezuela.
James, were you surprised, one, about this, about the outcome? And two, how will the left perceive it inside either the FARC or former FARC or other progressive social movements? Obviously, the right won, but is there a silver lining anywhere in this?
Well, I think the main silver lining in Colombia is that you saw the left come together around Petro. Unfortunately, the center part of the center-left coalition didn't come together strongly enough. If they had, Petro probably would have won. But there was a big push from people in the center to vote blank. The Sergio Fajardo, the third-place winner in the first round of presidential elections, didn't back Petro. But it's significant that the left came together because, as we know throughout the world, you know, the left has its own divisions in various places, but it's really impressive that I've seen the Colombian left come together again and again and again when the times demanded it. In terms of the future, all I can say is that the popular movements continue to be very strong, and they really have no choice but to keep going on. We have to support them internationally, and we also have to continue. It's really great that you're having me talking about Colombia and discussion about Venezuela at the same time, because they are so intertwined. And I think internationally, in terms of both Colombia and Venezuela solidarity, we have to expose the lies that are made, the accusations about the political process in Venezuela, while the mainstream news virtually never pays attention to the travesties of what takes place in every single election in Colombia, including now, which is with just a great deal of intimidation, threats against popular movements. But the popular movements remain strong.
I'm just a question for both of you, and which of you can goes first is your decision. But what's the status right now for the demobilized or disarmed armed groupings like FARC, who have, in exchange for giving up their armed struggle, entered into a political process with the ascendancy of a more far right candidate as the or presidency? What's likely to happen? You mentioned sort of or referred to increasing repression. What can the left do? What can the demobilized or now disarmed former guerrilla soldiers do in the face of that? Or what are they doing?
I think we're still figuring that out. I mean, what we've already seen is that in areas like in the south of Colombia and Nariño and other places, the situation has just descended into chaos. The vacuum left by the FARC and the inability, or really not the inability, but the unwillingness of the government to move in and make necessary rural development and land reforms that they promised to make, has just led to a complete situation of chaos. And I don't think we really know what the future is going to be for the peace process or the armed conflict. Other than that, I know that the official FARC political party is still vowing to continue defending the peace process and continue participating in civil society. But I also know that Santos is trying, you know, to work out some sort of deal with the ELN. I don't know what this can possibly portend for the ELN or the FARC members who refuse to join the peace process. It doesn't look good. The violence against social movements and against former combatants is continuing unabated, and a Duque presidency, I doubt, is going to do very much to change that. The Trump administration is pushing for the government to adopt policies that are out of keeping with the peace accords, and I expect Duque to be very amenable to the Trump administration on that. So it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's bring Paul Dobson in. We only have about 2 minutes left, Paul. Again, well, go ahead. You go first, and then I follow up just about how this will play out inside of Venezuela, how it's interpreted by those who are the supporters of the Bolivarian process.
Well, what I was just going to say is that it's worth remembering that the Colombian-Venezuelan border is very extensive and with very little controls. If the new government of Colombia did start to repress the not just the guerrilla fighters in Colombia, but the people in the way that we have seen before, especially under the government of Álvaro Uribe, I would expect a similar consequence, which will be a mass immigration across into Venezuela, which is what we saw in those years. It's also worth remembering that not just the people of Colombia very freely cross into Venezuela, but also there's a lot of meddling from the Colombian state in Venezuelan affairs. There's been numerous examples in the last few years of Colombian financing for political hitmen, for assassinations. One of the most famous examples is Robert Serra, a deputy of the National Assembly, who was killed by somebody who financed him from Cúcuta, Colombia, who was in fact very closely connected to Álvaro Uribe. So with the new president Duque, who very much is a continuation of Uribe's line, I think we can expect an increase in these sorts of attacks within Venezuelan territory, financing, sending in arms, and so on. And here within Venezuela, there's a lot of interest in the elections, especially on the streets. There's a lot of Colombian people in Venezuela who have Colombian families. And of course, there's a lot of people who are currently emigrating from Venezuela into Colombia, so who are keeping a keen eye on Colombian visa restrictions and so on. And also the issue of the border itself, which is very, like I say, very uncontrolled. But there is a big problem of smuggling of subsidized goods from Venezuela into Colombia, petrol and food products especially. And also a lot of smuggling of Venezuelan vices, we could say, back into Venezuela. Of Colombian vices, sorry, back into Venezuela. So the issue of the border, which has been an issue which the government have tried to create some sort of cooperation with the current government in Colombia in recent years, I think will be very keen to try to promote with a new government.
That was the voice of Paul Dobson. He joined us from Mérida, Venezuela. Paul's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We were also joined from Tucson, Arizona by James Jordan. He's a member of the Alliance for Global Justice and has been deeply involved in supporting the Colombian peace process. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bill, there is an outrageous report from NBC News on how some charter schools, there's one in particular, are resegregating and doing it somehow within the confines of the law. Can you explain to us how this is happening?
First of all, I don't think it's exactly resegregating. I don't think we've ever integrated the schools. But the strategies, particularly in the Deep South, although the strategies run to New York, San Francisco, Chicago, and everywhere else, the strategies vary. But you remember when the Brown versus Board of Education was first enacted, Southern school districts created private schools, private academies, and they were all white, and they were an attempt to avoid, again, the possibility of integration. What you're referring to is a study by the Hechinger Report that really highlights something quite amazing. In rural Georgia, a school that's a charter school for all white kids has not only bright hallways and classrooms, but high ceilings, oversized windows, but also a piano lab with 25 pianos, 10 of them donated by residents of the nearby exclusive gated community that uses this charter school, right? So this is something we've talked about before, you know, that the privileged have for their children all kinds of amenities, and they would never send their kids to a school that doesn't have, for example, math, science, the arts. And, you know, from our point of view, yours and my point of view, I think, and many of your listeners, education means nothing unless it's an education that opens your imagination, that allows you to think differently. And what we see in these kind of moves to resegregate, to create one set of schools for the privileged, for the white, for the traditionally privileged people, and another set of skills for traditionally oppressed and exploited people. And that's what we're seeing. I think it's very revealing, and people should see the NBC report.
Yeah, June 17th, yesterday, it was posted.
So it's worth looking at because you'll see visuals of a school that anybody would want to send their kids to. The problem is black folks have no access to it. Another feature of that particular segregated academy charter school is that there is no transportation to the school, no public transportation and no bus service. Therefore, you have to have a car and drive your kid to school. Well, it's rural Georgia, so the distances are not short, except for the folks in this gated community. So it's just an outrage. And they skirt the law and they pretend that they're doing something legal. But, you know, and it may be technically legal, especially with our Supreme Court, but it doesn't make it any more egregious.
Yeah, Bill Ayers is our guest. Bill is an award-winning educator, lifelong activist for peace and civil rights. He joins us every Monday here on Loud and Clear, where we talk about education. Education for liberation, unlike the current public education system. Bill, this area in rural Georgia is actually under court order because of a previous practice of, a longtime practice, enduring practice of racial segregation. So it's under a desegregation order. And yet using the charter school system, they can use public funds and take those public funds away from other public schools, including the school right down the street from where the, I think it's the Lake Oconee Academy is, where the 73% of the students are white. Down the road at Green County's other public school, 12% of the students are white. And so you have, in the name of diversity, in the name of giving parents a choice, we're creating, at least in vast parts of the South, and I also say in the North as well, and as Malcolm X said, the South started at the U.S.-Canadian border, but it's a systematic sort of transfer of money and resources to the affluent, to the middle class, to white people. And let's just talk about, while this study is about what was going on during the Obama administration, this is happening on steroids now with the Betsy DeVos decimation strategy towards public education.
Well, yeah, I mean, we should understand, and I think we do understand, that explicitly the neoliberal strategy for education is designed to devour public education. That's its explicit strategy. And attacks on public education that we've seen for decades, but we see it, as you say, on steroids now. These are attacks on communities of color and on poor communities and on working class people. So let's not be confused about it. And there are a couple of analogies worth noting. One is the recent Supreme Court decision around voting rights that came out of Ohio. What did the civil rights movement, which we celebrate in the mainstream as something that was wonderful and accomplished so much, it was a movement for justice, but tactically it wanted voting rights and it wanted to integrate the public schools. Where are we today, 50 years after, Selma, 50 years after, 50 plus years after the Voting Rights Act? We are seeing this all be taken away. And the lesson we should take from this is that imperialism never means its withdrawals. It withdraws tactically, but it never means it in a deep sense. And that means that we have to not only be vigilant, we have to be conscious of building a social movement that's unstoppable. We didn't get voting rights or integrated schools or the aspiration of integrated schools from simply asking for it. We got it by building a social movement from fire from below. And this is something that we have to recommit ourselves to because it's an essential thing. One other point I'd like to make is that this question of school integration, which liberals, for the most part, Arne Duncan included, Peter Cunningham included, have said many times recently that we tried integration and it didn't work. That is a false statement. That is an absolute lie. Integration has never been tried, racial integration on a massive scale. But I really recommend that your listeners look up Nicole Hannah-Jones. Google her. She's a reporter for the New York Times. And she has two incredible stories in the New York Times over the last couple of years. One is called Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City. And it's about New York City. It's not about rural Georgia. And the other is called The Resegregation of Jefferson County. And it's a story of an Alabama school district that inadvertently had to integrate for a short period of time. And it was a wild success. So this idea that it's been tried and failed is utter nonsense. It's been resisted from day one, and we've never achieved it. And we have to get busy if we want to live in a society that is in balance, based on joy and justice, allowing every human being to be taken seriously as an incalculably valuable being, then we have to get busy and get to work on this.
Bill, the Education for Liberation Network has a conference coming up called Free Minds, Free People. It's a national conference, and it's going to be, I think, in the Twin Cities. Tell us about that and about how people can get involved.
Well, go online and find Free Minds, Free People. I've been to several of the conferences in the last few years, but it is a gathering of progressive educators, of community organizers and activists, of wonderful teachers, and the exchanges are robust and vital and vibrant. It's going to take place in Minneapolis, St. Paul, July 11th to 14th, 2019. So we'll refer to it again and again as we go along. So it's a year away, but it is a marvelous gathering of folks who are challenging the kind of obstacles that we face to our humanity. And I think it's worth everyone kind of putting it in their calendar and looking forward to it. and starting to organize groups of folks to participate. Every time I've been there, there have been grassroots folks, there have been kids, there have been school groups who are doing marvelous, innovative things that you're not going to read about in the New York Times.
Yeah, Bill, we have about 1 minute left. One of the issues we discussed earlier was about the issue of children at the border and specifically the separation of children from their parents by U.S. officials. But I know you as an educator have thoughts about the impact on those kids' educational development.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're witnessing on the border, I think all of us feel is absolutely unconscionable. And to separate kids, I mean, I worked in early childhood for years. Separating a kid for a morning, a four-year-old to go to preschool, can be quite anxiety-producing. Imagine the harrowing nature of taking a trip across Mexico, making it into the United States, and being a 3, 4, 5, or 15-year-old kid and having your mother seized and taken in one direction and you're taken in another and put in a cage. CBS was told yesterday by border agents not to call the kids living in cages. And the CBS people looked over and said, but they are cages. And the guy said, yeah, they are cages, but don't call them cages. This is a blow to anyone's sense of being developed as a full human being. It's an absolute outrage, and we have to rise up against it.
Absolutely right. We're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Bill Ayers. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, until next week, you're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, John and Brian.
Chris, we exchange articles before we do this segment, and there's so much in the news. We just don't have the time to cover it all. I'm going to jump actually a little ahead to something that's been important to me personally, and that is DNA testing with consumer genetic testing companies. 23andMe, Ancestry.com, everybody's doing it now. They've made it so cheap, you almost can't avoid doing it. But there are some risks involved in these kinds of companies. Talk about that.
Sure. So people are often reaching out to a company like 23andMe or Ancestry or many of the other startups in this space because they want to find out, do they have a risk for a certain type of illness, or they want to find out more about their genetic history. Ancestry and 23andMe can tell you, you know, where, based on your DNA, your family was from, which for many people is, you know, an important personal thing to know for them. The problem with this is that these are all private companies. And there are very few regulations as to what these companies can do with your information. So CNBC actually has a good article, this one you're talking about, on five of the risks, and I think there are more. Number one is hacking. We've seen so many in security space, in financial spaces, in social media spaces, you know, companies get hacked and passwords get leaked. Now, what happens if your genetic information also gets leaked? But then the big question is, who profits from it and how can they profit from it? Like I said, there's very little regulation of any kind in this space, and we need to be very concerned about how they're going to profit from this. Just like they sell, you know, Facebook sells and Google sells our, you know, what we're looking at online, our interests, our interactions, they can start selling our genetic information.
Right. And, you know, so many consumers say, well, I'm going to opt into this sharing of my genetic data because it's for research, right? Somebody's going to find a cure for Parkinson's disease or for cancer, and I want to be part of that research. But we don't really know that that's the case. We hope that the companies are sharing it for research purposes, but we don't really know that, do we?
No one ever reads the terms and conditions. And unfortunately, these privacy policies and terms can change at any time. And, you know, maybe you get an email from the company that says, hey, our terms and conditions are changing. Go read this extremely long legal document. But who does that? Very few people do that. And the companies intentionally make these things complicated so that we don't read it. And they're very difficult for the average layperson to understand. If you're not a lawyer, it's very difficult to understand these documents. People are interested in having this information, and I think it says a lot that people want to be able to share this information for good purposes, like medical research. Just like we share information on social media to connect with our friends and family and connect with people who have the same interests with as us, what they don't tell us is how is the nefarious uses that this technology can have.
And speaking of nefarious uses, a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, authorities in California captured a serial killer, the Golden State Killer, who had eluded them since the 1970s. And after he was arrested, the police came forward and said that they had actually cracked the case by using DNA results from a relative of his that came from a genealogy company. And they were able to narrow it down to a member of this person's family who had gone to whatever company it was. I don't think they told us whether it was 23andMe or one of the others. And that's how they caught this killer. It's great that they caught a killer, but what that tells us is that when the cops want access to our private genetic information, they can get it.
That's right. I believe it was his brother. I'm not entirely sure about that. You know, with the police, if they have a database of fingerprints, they can't tell who's your family member based on that. And, you know, many of us have certainly been fingerprinted by police if you've had an interaction with them. But they're not collecting your DNA necessarily. But now that these databases are open, and many of these companies willingly and openly will give the information to police, provided generally they get a warrant. Some of the companies, like 23andMe, will issue a report about how many warrants and subpoenas they've worked with, but that there's no regulation for them that requires them to do that. So we just don't know.
Let's change topics for a second, Chris. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal today talking about the police use of facial recognition with license databases. There was also a piece in today's Washington Post saying that Amazon is starting to use facial recognition as a sign-in to your account so you can buy things. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I'm more concerned about the facial recognition with the police, but also this still ties into Amazon because Amazon has a system called Recognition. It spells it with a K, that is doing this kind of mass facial recognition, and they are working with police and providing this information to police. So police using facial recognition technology isn't actually anything new. It's getting more widespread now, but there have been test cases in many cities where they've been doing that. Unfortunately, now with Amazon openly working with police and openly saying that they're going to use this technology when they're analyzing photos, it's going to be even more widespread. You know, there was a statement put out by a number of civil liberties groups, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who, you know, I've said before, I'm a huge fan of, decrying the, you know, Amazon's partnership with law enforcement. And I fully agree with that. But I think we also need to take that further. We need to condemn just the private use of this information by Amazon itself and whoever its ad partners are. We should own this information about ourselves, and we should control who has access to it and what they're doing with it.
Absolutely right. There's another thing that you sent over that actually frightened me. You wrote here that Google is training machines to predict when a patient will die. That last year, British regulators slapped a company called DeepMind, which is another artificial intelligence lab, for testing an app that analyzed public medical records without telling patients that their information was going to be used like this. What's that all about?
That's right. And we should be clear, DeepMind is also owned by Google's parent company, Alphabet. So it's effectively the same corporate company. It's scary that Google is doing this. And again, the intention, I think, if you look at it from a high level, is very interesting. Can we analyze medical data to predict illness or predict lifespan? And then the next step would be, what can we do to cure illness or to treat people better? But that's not necessarily what they're doing. They're just looking at numbers. And this is a huge problem in tech today. People just look at the algorithm and the numbers that can come out of it, and then they take that and say, how can we make a profit off of it, without thinking of the social and economic implications of what that is for the people that they're using the data of.
I want to just go back real quick, one other point. So you had all these civil liberties groups demanding that Amazon stop selling facial recognition technology to the police. Amazon itself has a $600 million contract, too, with the CIA.
That's right.
Why would we think, not that their contract is for this, but why would we think that Amazon would not be also sharing this information with, say, the CIA or the FBI.
I think that's a safe assumption to make. I have no reason to believe, given what we know about the CIA, the NSA, and other so-called national security agencies, really spy agencies, that they're not sharing. We know through the PRISM program that Edward Snowden revealed that many of these online companies, you know, do share data, and we have no reason to believe that Amazon doesn't.
We have about a minute and a half left, Chris. I want to ask you about this hearing that's going to take place on Capitol Hill. Senators from both parties, led by Jeff Flake, a Republican from Arizona, and Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware, they are going to talk to Amazon about the privacy of the new Echo device. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is a really bizarre case. A woman claims that a conversation that she had with somebody in her household was recorded and sent to her coworker. Amazon is saying that the device picked up some trigger words, the words that you use to, to activate the device, and then interpreted the conversation and then heard her say, "Send it to," and then a coworker, and that's why it was sent. But it just underscores we need to be so aware of all these microphones that we are willingly putting in our homes or our offices and what they're picking up. And even if this was a bug, even if it was an accident, it opens up so many questions about where our information goes from these devices and how much control we really have over them.
John, we're happy to let our listeners know that starting next Monday, this segment, which is coming every Monday, is going to go from an 12-minute segment to a 30-minute segment with Chris Garofa. That's really interesting because there are too many issues on the technology front to cover in 11 or 12 minutes. So, Chris, we want to really, really thank you for joining us every week. And now, again, for our listeners, it'll be, well, it's a 30-minute segment. That's about a 27-minute interview right here on Loud and Clear every Monday. But, John, I think we're out of time.
We are out of time. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garofa. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.